Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning for this Monday, the 23rd of April. Very nice to have you with us on this Monday morning. Yes, 9:14, and welcome. Let me just remind you, if you want to be a part of our conversation, I got to remind you.
Yeah. Why not?
Got to remind you that if
you... What are you, some kind of left winger or something?
Right. I mean, come on. It's really, you're one of the people.
Pipple.
Those people, too.
One of the pipple.
All right, we'll try it again. I want to remind you that if you would like to be a part of our conversation, all you have to do is go to panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. Let me introduce that group to you because they are magnificent and I want to share... WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Joe. I just want to take a moment to congratulate you on what you pulled together on Friday. That was an extraordinary event. People loved it. We've been getting mail all weekend long, and I know how hard you worked on it. And again, thank you.
Well, and thank you. I appreciate that. It was. If you weren't there on a Friday, I hope you got to listen to it. And if you haven't listened to it yet, it's online, and listen to our climate change panel. It was really special. It was a very nice event. Teresa was there. We got to have her in our audience, and pretty fun, huh?
It was spectacular. I mean, it was just really, really wonderful. And not only talking about the problem, but lots of solutions. That's what I liked. Really in-depth discussion of the issues. Incredible panelists.
It's not a contest, but I just want to say for the listener who, any listeners who were there and laughed or people who just wondered, but at 12:30, Terry was still signing books.
Wow.
Just for the record.
Wow.
It was really something. So to Terry Tebbis Williams, Elizabeth Colbert, the wonderful Jeff Goodell, and of course our Judith Enck, thanks to all of them for being so wonderful and putting on such a great event on Friday. And also to our friends at the Writers Institute for giving us the space. We had a nice time over at Page Hall. Dan Arizari is here. We are thrilled to have him, chairman of the Capital District Latinos, and been a little while since we've seen you, so welcome back. Good morning to you.
It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me again.
A great thrill.
You should come more often.
Thank you.
And Libby Post is here. She is our... Good morning.
Good morning.
She is our political consultant and apolitical consultant. She is, I don't want to say you're ours, but you are our commentator.
If you want to run for office or something.
No, this is enough. Thank you.
Stuff. Okay, fine.
But thank you very much for being here. We always love having you. So good
I love
morning.
Being here.
All right. Let us go to the news of the day and get started and talk to everybody. Well, first of all, there's a new royal baby, so we should start
Yay.
On that.
It was born?
Yes.
Yes, the Duchess of Cambridge has given birth to a boy. The third child of Catherine and Prince William was born Monday morning. This just came out about 45 minutes ago. And 8 pounds, 7 ounces. And
that's healthy.
We don't have a name yet, but I'm sure that will come. So... well, I guess that will come.
You wonder how those guys feel when they grow up and know that, you know.
They could have been, but they're not. But,
yeah, right.
I'm third in line, and behind my sister, no less.
But maybe you, as you grow up, you're also like, oh, thank God.
I think Harry's probably in that.
Yes. And I think Prince Andrew is very much in there, thank God. You know, Charles's brother, Andrew, and the other one, Edward. I think it's Edward who's really happy that he's not.
Have you ever watched The Crown?
Oh, yeah, it's great. Yeah. I love
it. Isn't that great? I mean,
yes,
you really get the nuances of that.
And then you get Victoria, too, when you put the two of them together. Oh, it was great.
It is great. Maybe this will make it into the series. Who knows?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it will. It's
eventually.
All good stuff. Well, all right. Now, so let's go to...
some of them get loopy, like, you know, Princess Margaret.
Oh, God, yeah, she certainly loopy, did.
Didn't she?
She was. And Helena Bonham Carter is going to play her now. In this series
of
The Crown. Right, so that should
she
be
She plays
interesting.
Loopy like nobody.
Yeah, see, this is what loopy. I talk about, reading People magazine. This is what you get for being keeping up on popular culture.
Notice I'm not in this conversation.
Right, Teresa didn't even know she was pregnant.
I did not know she was pregnant, but I did know she had the baby. I learned this morning two things. A, she was pregnant, and B, she had the baby.
We have been on Royal Watch for a long time, Teresa.
No,
you have
idea.
To.
I had no
okay.
idea.
I have a I have
Thank
a member.
Thank you, Libby, for letting everyone know.
I have a member of my family who has already changed our schedule to accommodate the royal wedding at 6 in the morning or whenever that is. So
I just want to say for the record, I've never been in a room with so many Anglophiles in my life.
I just want to say for the record,
privileged.
Alan and I are Jewish, so really not.
I didn't know it's St. George's Day, which apparently is a big deal, and that the baby was born on St. George's Day, but I really don't know why that's a big deal. But
St. George, yeah, the Slayer of Dragons. Is that?
It's right, the Slayer of Dragons. Mm-hmm. I just saw that online.
All right. Well, you know, we have about 10 minutes, and I thought...
we're not going to spend it on the baby?
I'm going to start on this story just because I think we'll talk about it because it's a good one, and then we'll move on to other stuff outside of New York. But the New York Times has this great article about the blood feud between Bill de Blasio and Andrew Cuomo, and it is it's their front page this morning. Inside one of America's ugliest political feuds, Cuomo versus de Blasio. I like this article because I didn't exactly remember slash know what sort of the seeds of this were, but apparently it goes back quite a ways, back to 2002, I guess, when Mr. Cuomo was badly trailing in the Democratic primary for governor, and he was seeking this graceful exit, and then he turns to Bill de Blasio. And then it's sort of there where things go south, I guess. And the point of this article is at that time they were collaborating, and it says the idea of Mr. de Blasio and Mr. Cuomo ever collaborating on anything seems almost unfathomable nearly 16 years later. The two Democrats are now engaged in a feud so nasty, petty, and prolonged that even in the cutthroat politics of New York, few can remember ever seeing anything quite like it. The two men have sparred over substance, silliness, and everything in between. Public housing, private workout routines, homelessness, and topless women in Times Square. Taxing millionaires and euthanizing a deer. A Legionnaire's disease outbreak. And state troop deployments, school snowstorms, and the subways. Even naps. I'm not a napper, really. Mr. Cuomo volunteered last year after reports of the mayor allege penchant for napping. I never have been. He can nap. I don't nap. Okay, so...
I nap.
Me
yeah,
too.
I nap. And
I
thank you for being.
I love it.
You should.
You need it.
20 minutes or so.
Yeah.
Power nap.
Yeah, right. Power nap, do everything. Well, anyway, so the point of this is ultimately to the contours of the feud and its effect have been puzzled over for years. Why would two men whose stated goals often run on similar tracks allow their one-time friendship, in the deepest sense of the word, as Mr. Cuomo once put it, to deteriorate into pure detest? This portrait of a relationship fractured is based on interviews with more than 2 dozen past and
Alan's,
present aides.
Alan wants to say something.
Advisors and officials who have worked. Okay, so go ahead.
Horshack.
Right. Yes, okay. Horshack. Ooh.
Well, first of all, we've been talking about this for a long time. And I have to say, it's all about the fact, and I didn't read it in the Times article, that they both want to be president of the United States. And I've said that. Now, how do we know that? We know that, you know, de Blasio, we know about Cuomo. He wants it. But de Blasio has been actually traveling to places like New Hampshire.
And Iowa.
You don't go to New Hampshire and Iowa, you know, because they are the outstanding vacation spots in America. They're the first people who vote. So that's what this is all about. I'm so old that I watched it with Rockefeller and Lindsay. They that's killed right. each other off yeah. also. So the idea that this is new is not. And it is disgraceful that they're behaving this way.
The article points to two things, which I think are interesting. One is that it's only worsened since the candidacy of Cynthia Nixon. Cynthia Nixon has a close alliance to Bill de Blasio. Of course, Governor Cuomo is believed to be seeking a third term. So that is also part of this. And this article says the latest flashpoint, the recent state budget that served as a cudgel to exert his dominance over Mr. de Blasio. He added new oversight to the city's mayor-run school system. He forced the mayor to hand over $418 million for subway repairs, threatening to garnish property taxes if Mr. de Blasio resisted. He gave $250 million to the city's beleaguered public housing system, but then declared a state of emergency and ordered an independent monitor.
So don't you think that's stupid? The reason I say that is because a lot of people live in New York City. And you mentioned Cynthia Nixon. Now, there's going to be a primary. Now, if a guy is bleeding your subways or being, you know, silly about continually putting other people in charge over the mayor, because the city, as you know from political science, is a creature of the state. Always, they could do anything they want, I just think it's very stupid on Cuomo's part. You know, he's very shrewd. He's one of the shrewdest politicians I have ever seen, but he's not always that smart. This is a dumb move on his part.
I just really wish that we wouldn't be spending time talking about these kinds of fights when you have something like NYCHA on the edges of insolvency and people living for years, Alan, with leaks and peeling paint and all of these horrible conditions. I mean, put aside the bickering and work on a solution, because so many people depend upon that housing stock that it's obscene that mm-hmm. we're still many years from when things were cresting long ago and we still have this unsolvable problem.
Oh,
so stop fighting and get to work.
Yeah. You're right.
This article, I'm talking about that, the exact moment that Mr. Cuomo was in Manhattan Ballroom condemning the city's public housing as disgusting, Mr. de Blasio was on the roof of a New York City Housing Authority development in Queens, swiping at the governor for acting like the Great White Knight. There are some politicians who suddenly believe it is stylish to visit NYCHA. He didn't leave it for people to read between the lines. Of course, I'm talking about the governor, Mr. de Blasio said when asked, let's be real. So, as you say, there's a lot of sniping.
NYCHA has been plagued with these problems for many. It's unfair to just lay it at de Blasio's doorstep.
Right, I agree
with
you.
It's been years and years that this problem has been percolating.
You're exactly right. And why did it take this long, all of a sudden, with an election coming up, to do this?
Because it's fashionable for, you know, this time of the year for poor people to kind of, you know, become a cause celeb, unfortunately. That's my take.
Libby, I'm hoping to hear you weigh in on this, if you want to.
Well, you know, I think it's unfortunate that this kind of stuff has to get aired, and I think it's unfortunate that that there's a zero-sum game perspective here, and I think that inherently, even though I, you know, make a living doing this work, I think that's what's inherently wrong with politics today, is that everybody sees it as a zero-sum game. If he has more, I have less. Instead of thinking about power as a sharing opportunity, which then would enable us to make life better for people who really need it.
Right.
You know, I don't think the people who are living in the housing projects care.
No.
They want to have running water. They want to be able to, you know, flush the toilet.
Not have mold.
Eat. Huh?
Not have mold.
Mold, right. You know, they want to be able to have a decent quality of life.
Right.
They don't care about what they see as just political squabbling.
Right.
And, you know, I think they're both to blame in this. And it's unfortunate that this is what it's come down to. And this is what's going to dominate the gubernatorial election from here until the primary. Not necessarily November, maybe.
You think it's just a matter of both being responsible. See, I see it a little bit differently.
I think
basically, as we used to say in our house, he started it. and I think Andrew started it.
What difference does it make who started it? The fact is we need to deal with the reality of what it all means to the people they need to serve.
It matters because one guy looks like a bully.
So I was going to ask Alan this question. This is a governor who, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know exactly the exact details here, but we have seen a governor who has been in some cases friendlier with, we see this in the Senate, we see this, yeah. He's been friendlier mm-hmm. with Republicans than he has been with Democrats. Yeah. There seems to be, in working with state officials across the state, that he has been friendlier mm-hmm. with people mm-hmm. Who are his adversaries than people that work, you know, his allies that work with him. And I mean, that is, doesn't that get to your point?
Well, no, the point here, yeah, it does get to my point. You're exactly right, Joe. What happens here is that you have a primary going on. So all of a sudden, a guy who has kept the Republicans in office in the Senate for all this time, because he wanted them there. That's obvious to me. It had to switch them over, and he wants credit for it. But people are saying, "Hey, you know, this has been going on for all these years. Where were you before there was an election?" And I think that's what it's about.
I think the hope is that more women will run for office,
right.
Because I think this is a problem that's for now that's unique to men in power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I gotta say, I'm ready for somebody else to take a whack at it because. Us guys are doing a pretty miserable job of it, and you know, hi, honey. I hope you're listening.
but don't be. But as Andrew said just recently to our Bill Lipton, who was on the Capital Connection a couple of weeks ago.
10 seconds.
What'd you say?
10 seconds.
Okay. Wait. He says, you know, don't be calling me. If you help somebody else, don't be calling me. That's going to be the big part of this campaign.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation, move on to other issues as well. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Well, good morning. Welcome back to The Roundtable. We have a couple of letters. We'll go to those, and then we'll move on to other topics and talk about other stuff that's been happening. Go ahead, Alan.
Well, Tim writes a thank you to you, Joe. Dear panel, thank you for the extraordinary climate change event you held on Friday. According to the exhaustive Yale Climate Opinion Survey, 75% of Americans say they hear about the climate crisis in the media once a month or less. So grateful to have a radio station that pays attention to this existential crisis, and that's Tim from Stone Ridge.
Thank you very much, Tim.
Yeah. Okay. Who said it?
Do you know?
Steve McQueen.
Oh, Steve McQueen.
Steve McQueen in, you know, Wanted Dead or Alive.
Steve McQueen.
Early in the morning, yeah. Okay. Kevin says, secession. Can the panel address some of the comments in the New York Times about the city seceding from the state? And that's from, it says here, Tab.
Well, we always hear about the Adirondacks were going to secede.
Long Island.
Vermont,
Long
everybody, Island. Right? So
Long Island.
I remember John Markey wanted Staten Island to secede, and I was like, bye-bye now.
It's not going to happen.
No,
it's never going to happen.
Yeah, no. So that ain't going to happen, right? Just won't happen, no.
All right, let's go on to other topics and talk about the hopes for the Iran nuclear deal. French, German leaders will bring Donald Trump the same message, save the Iran nuclear deal. President Trump faces a European double bill this week as a crucial deadline looms for a decision on whether to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal. French President Emmanuel Macron and German Chancellor Angela Merkel arriving back-to-back will bring a unified message, save the deal. I don't have any plan B for nuclear protections against Iran, Macron said Sunday on Fox News. Let's preserve the framework because it's better than a sort of North Korea-type situation. Iran's foreign minister made the point more dramatically, warning that if Trump quits the 2015 accord, Tehran may respond by relaunching and intensifying its now blocked nuclear program. The Iranian foreign minister who helped negotiate the deal said on CBS's Face the Nation that Iran might consider resuming at much greater speed its nuclear activities. I think the international community has seen that the United States under this administration has not been in a mood to fulfill its obligations, he said, so that makes the United States not very trustworthy. This is from the Los Angeles Times. The dual nuclear dilemmas, Iran and North Korea, are coming to a head in a dramatically short span of time. Trump has vowed to scrap the 2015 Iran accord unless France, Germany, and Britain can fix it. his words, unless revisions are made, he has vowed not to sign another waiver of U.S. sanctions on May 12th, the next deadline potentially wrecking the deal. Teresa, I will defer to you on this.
It's hard to understand how Trump could renege on the Iranian deal at the same time he's trying to make a deal, allegedly trying to make a deal with North Korea. And so this is really an amazing week. You have Macron coming today, going to plant a tree at the White House, an oak tree, and then they're going to Mount Vernon. And then state dinner, to which first time no Democrats invited to the state dinner. And then you have White House meetings tomorrow and Wednesday. He's going to speak to a joint session of the Congress. And then you have Merkel coming on Friday. And then you have the South Koreans and the North Koreans meeting as well this week. So a good week to turn off Fox News, CNN and MSNBC, and go Google newspapers from other countries to get their perspective, by the way, because I've been trying to do that. It's fascinating. But there's three main troubling items on the agenda for both Macron and Merkel. And they're, in some ways, the negotiations on them are interrelated. You have the tariffs fight, and you have, because they want to impose tariffs. And then you have the Syria situation, who's going to pay to fix Syria and what to do in Syria. And then you have this Iran deal. And Trump is doing this without a Secretary of State, because at this same week, which is a major international week, today on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, you're going to have them report out Pompeo without the support of the committee, reportedly, because the Democrats and Rand Paul oppose him. Now, he'll probably get approved sometime later this week in the Senate, but weakened because of that. So how does he renege on this deal and ever make another deal in the future?
Well, I have a theory, and my theory is his book, The Art of the Deal, tells you all about what goes on. No matter what there is on the table, he says less, please, or more, please. He does that because he thinks it's worked for him in the past, and it may have in his somewhat shady real estate negotiations, but this ain't that. So it's always say it's no good that way and see what happens.
Alan, is it, to me, him going against the deal was just a campaign rhetoric. Mm. Do you think he has any deep view about this deal? I think the problem is this is an Obama deal. What are his deep reservations? Or who's talking to him that has these deep reservations? What's guided this? To me, it's just campaign rhetoric. Obama did it, so he's against it.
Could be. But, you know, one of my favorite TV shows is the one where, you know, they come in and they show the guy behind the... Joe, you'll know the name of this. They show the guy behind the counter something they want to sell. And he said, "How much you want for it?" And the guy always says, I want $3,000 for it." Immediately, the guy says, "I'll give you $2,000, or I'll give you $200 for it." What's the show?
But
you know the Alan, show. It's that
Pawn Stars.
Yes.
Yeah. No. Oh, okay.
But
right.
Alan,
yeah,
but
B A W N. Just some, to be clear.
Good for
Alan,
you. I love that show.
The thing is, though, you know, as has been reported, two of the things that he complains about the deal, which is ballistic missiles, Iran's production of ballistic missiles, and then their support of militant groups in the Middle East. That's not even in the deal. So he's opposed to these aspects that aren't even in the deal. And then he says, well, you know, they never declared that they wouldn't restart their program. But as was pointed out yesterday, it's in the first couple paragraphs of the deal. The thing that he says is not there is in the first couple paragraphs of the deal. This is just, I think he's wedded to a rhetorical campaign point, and now he's disrupting the, you know, Middle East because of his rhetorical campaign point. Do you think that Donald Trump could talk through the substance of this deal with anyone?
No, because he can't spell counsel. This morning he tweeted, and he was talking about special counsel spelled wrong, CIL.
Yeah, right.
Well, I think you're trying to read too much into what is basically foreign policy that's formulated on Fox and Friends and then tweeted out later on a few minutes later. And that's unfortunately not far from, I mean, that's just not hyperbole or
did you see what CNN did? They put they juxtaposed Trump and Fox broadcasters and almost word for word what he says and what they say over a 24-hour period.
I find, I think it's interesting. This is a total aside, but something interesting, and maybe the Media Project will take this up. But the CNN's coverage now of what Fox is covering is interesting. They they play a lot of clips and they look at that impact that one has on the other, which I think is insightful and interesting. Yes,
not directly following up on what you said, but the other thing is that Merkel, who he does not get along that with, certainly Macron is trying to do a charm offensive. And what did he do? He went on Fox yesterday,
and he did
one interview. Macron did, and he sent his message on all of these things on Fox. But German Chancellor Angela Merkel is this week with the Mexico president in a conference in Germany and just announced a big trade deal between Mexico and the European Union. And that's going to be announced, the details of it announced today. And you know that that isn't by accident as she comes to the U.S. and trying to talk about the tariff issue.
Well, what about the whole thing about BMWs whipping around everywhere? This is his analysis, that BMWs are whipping around everywhere, and it's unfair that Germany has this like ability to just dump all its wonderful cars into our market. When in fact, Germany, I think something I read recently said it points out that 680,000 jobs
They're built
were created because of these so-called cars that are zipping around the United States, much to Trump's chagrin.
On Fox, Macron was pretty firm on this tariff issue, you know, and he talked about why is he getting into trade war with his allies? And if you step back and think about this, you know, Trump is really at odds with Germany, Great Britain, Theresa May has not
our allies
and France. And, you know, they're the key people in this deal. And did you see what Bloomberg did yesterday?
Yeah.
You know, the U.S. reneged on the Paris Climate Accord. So Bloomberg yesterday announced that he's going to pay the U.S. share of the climate for another year, the $4 million, just to keep us in the talks.
2020.
Yeah. And I know that this sounds a little People Magazine-ish. However... Trump's hatred of Obama and the Iran deal and everything else probably got ratcheted up a little bit by the pictures that came out from the Bush funeral.
Extraordinary.
Where Melania is sitting next to Obama. She's actually smiling, and they're having a lovely little interchange. At
so
least
gracious.
The picture, right, the picture speaks a thousand words, and then they were all together. You know, so I think that there might be a little bit of needling here, and this man, Trump, will respond in the most childishly emotional ways to things like this, and then it impacts our policy.
I think you're absolutely right, but I don't know if this is protocol, but I thought it was a nice gesture. Maybe you know this, Teresa. But she brought members of the White House staff with her to the funeral who had served with Mrs.
Lovely.
Bush as her guests to come so that they could be at the funeral as well, which I thought was a very nice
lovely.
Gesture, you know, so they could get the opportunity to pay their respects to someone that they had worked for and obviously were very fond of. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. 11 minutes before the hour of 10 o'clock, and we have Alan Chartok, Dan Irizarry, Teresa Bourgeois, and Libby Post making up the panel this morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Talking just before the break going in about the Iran deal, and we have a letter there, Alan. We welcome more, of course.
Yeah. Barbara says, Fraternity Video. Isn't it ironic that a group of frat boys can be expelled from college for making a video at a private party degrading women, making racist comments, and poking fun at the disabled, yet a person can do it publicly on TV and at political rallies and still be elected president?
Yep.
I have thought a lot about that, actually, over the last several months. When anybody does something online and they say, oh, this person said this on Twitter and they should lose their job and lose their endorsements and everything. And I'm not sure they shouldn't, but meanwhile.
Meanwhile, right.
Meanwhile at the White House.
Right.
Right. I know this is petty and stupid, but it's just like, when he starts off a tweet of sleepy-eyed Chuck Todd, really?
And
he's a child.
I was not aware that that was a racial slur.
Sleepy-eyed? Yeah, it's Asian. I would think it's.
I read last night that it's a Jewish slur. I did not know that. Do you
don't
know
look
this?
At me, I don't know.
I've never heard
it was
that.
There was a thing on.
Chuck's not Jewish.
I'd never
My
heard
ears
that.
Are asleep. I didn't hear it.
Yeah. Sleepy-eyed, huh?
Sleepy-eyed. All I'd right. never seen that before. Okay. Anyway.
Everybody's madly going to their computer
sleepy-eyed
right now.
Sleepy-eyed meaning. Ready to fall asleep. Urban. Another term for puffy-eyed stoners.
All right.
on a can I read on a positive note this tweet about the picture? So there was this lovely picture about with the Bushes and the Clintons and Melania Trump, and this guy wrote on Twitter of the picture. He said, an immigrant, a son of one, a war hero, a descendant of slaves, a librarian, a sober alcoholic, four presidents, the first black one, the first woman nominee, four lawyers, an MBA, a model from the South, the North, the Midwest, Pacific Islands, and Eastern Bloc. America is various. I thought that was lovely. That's what's good about America.
Yes.
Yeah, but the question I'm getting from everybody these days is how could it be, A, that we elected this guy, or that whatever happened here?
or whatever that was.
Yeah, well, because, you know, it's electoral college, there's a lot of debate, that kind of thing. But it really does come down to a significant portion of this country believing this crap. Mm-hmm. That is what is so amazingly disappointing. About all of this, because it is the answer, you know.
I think I've mentioned in this program before that I come from a religious background, a raising. My father was a pastor in East Harlem during the 40s and the 50s. He was really a social worker, which is what pastors were from immigrant communities back then. And my problem with all of this is that I think the religious right, the evangelicals, have given him a pass, and that is the community that I'm most disturbed about, because if you look at things in terms of faith, I mean, this guy is on the opposite end of the spectrum. I mean, you know, besides the whole 2 Corinthians walk into a bar kind of episode, there is a whole idea of loving your neighbor and of taking care of the stranger and of taking care of those least among us, which he has in no way embodies. And so I just have a horrible problem with that part, and I don't consider myself part of that community at all, because I still have faith that guides me, but it's nowhere near the right-wing evangelical ideology. But that really disturbs me, that they can cloak Trump in religiosity and make him palatable to a group of people who I really think have been hoodwinked.
Put a different way, I don't know how to do this sensitively, but assuming there is a Jesus, what is Jesus thinking right now?
Yeah, right.
What would Jesus do?
Yeah, right? There's a great video of a black Jesus coming to a white guy in a church. Was done in Britain. Mm-hmm. And the guy's like, "You're not Jesus." And he's like, "Yes, you know, think back 3,600 years ago, blah, 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 all that sort of stuff." But this is about two issues for the evangelical right. It has nothing to do with them thinking that he's really a Christian. Nope. It has to do with choice and gay rights. Yep. Those are the two issues. Mm-hmm. Because he is anti-choice.
You forgot about Israel, though, too.
Well, Israel, a big part of it. The whole thing about Israel is that they want to make sure Israel's there for the second coming so that they can all go up in the rapture. I mean, they're really
well. No,
is
there
their,
is there, absolutely there is
shtick. There with is Israel.
Yeah, There is that part of it too.
Yeah, I mean that definitely.
And meanwhile, we're there in some perverted sense of Christianity. They're like, well, we have to hasten the apocalypse.
Yeah, right.
I don't get that. I think, you know, the end times will come whenever they come. Who needs people to intervene in what is supposed to be like a divine? I mean, if you follow that.
Right. But I think they want the end times to come because they can't stand the fact that women have the ability to control their own bodies, that gays and lesbians and bisexual and transgender people can be employed, can teach their children. This is the kind of stuff that... get married. This is the kind of stuff that really, you know, twists their souls to the point where we should just destroy it all and start all over. And I have one thing to tell them. When they start all over, women will still be able to control their bodies and there will still be LGBT people.
All right. This is where we would clap, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. okay, let's go to other stories. And the other thing that happened over the weekend was this Waffle House shooting in Tennessee. And the story is bizarre on a couple of fronts, not the least of which is that the guy walked into the store naked and just started shooting people. That's one part of it, obviously.
He did have a coat on.
A green jacket.
Okay, well, all right. But later we found out that among the four weapons that they found, he's still on the loose, by the way.
Yes.
But an AR-15 semi-automatic rifle that was used in Waffle House. There was a pistol that's missing from his apartment. Meanwhile, this was the guy who crossed a security barrier at the White House in July, and they went to his house in Springfield, Illinois, and confiscated his guns and revoked his firearms license. And then the guns were later returned to his father, who then gave them back to his kid.
That's incredible.
To show some
really
of this.
Don't do that.
Yeah.
Well, right. It seems like it shows a microcosm of the problems that we have with guns in this country. And many of the debates that we're having that the kids from Parkland and elsewhere are talking about, this is a small slice of what's going on out there.
One can only think about what the legal implications of the father having given the kid these guns are back. It's extraordinary. I don't know what the law is out there.
I don't know. Well, if the sins of the father, I don't know. I don't think so.
Under Illinois law, certain confiscated guns can be released to a family member, but Ryan King, the father, could not lawfully possess the weapons in that state. It's unclear whether possessing the weapons was illegal in the state of Tennessee.
Want to bet?
But I also thought that they gave it back to him with the agreement that he would lock them up.
Giving it back to the kid with the agreement?
No, to the father. The guns were returned to the father with the agreement that they would be locked up. But what about the law of common sense? If the problem here is that, again, this man, by all these reports, must have some serious challenges.
29 years old, and yes.
And he's been arrested several times, and why would you put weapons in the hands of somebody like that?
Well, and now legislators are putting forth legislation saying people on medical marijuana can't own guns, but the mentally ill, this guy can. I mean, it's... Yeah.
But cheers to the man who
James Shaw
him.
Jr.
Yes, right.
A man who stood up and saved a lot of people, and was able to he lunged at the gunman. He wrestled away the weapon. He tossed it over the counter. The suspect did get away. But Mr. Shaw certainly saved a lot of lives in that very
AR-15.
And he was injured in the encounter.
So there are four people who will never see their children, their wives, their parents again as a result of being
mostly
there.
Young people.
They were young.
They were in their
20s. They were so young.
So there are four people who will not, even though he will.
Right.
Which is why, here come the letters, I feel in some sympathy for those people who are now saying, okay, because Mario used to say it to me all the time. The only thing he'll be thinking of for the rest of his life is sitting in a jail cell hearing the sound of a flushing toilet. That's what they. That's what he said. Now we have people who, after serving a certain number of years and having killed people, are allowed out. Now, I can get it. I get the idea of not doing a death penalty. I get it for a society. I'm not always sure I always like it, but I get it. But then don't let them out, because those four people who died, they'll never talk to their parents again or the rest of it. Mm-hmm. I say keep these guys in jail because
forever.
That's forever. That's what it's about.
29, 20, 23, 21, and then the two in the hospital, one in very critical condition. They're 21 and 24. I don't know which one is. One of them is critical but stable, and the other is very critical. You know, young people, their whole lives ahead of them.
All right, we're going to take a break, and we'll go over to news with Ray Graff. We will continue our conversation when we come back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Dan Irizarry, Teresa Bourgeois, and Libby Post joining us this morning. I know before the break we were talking the president. We mentioned that the president tweeted the term sleepy-eyed Chuck Todd. You did a little research.
Right. It is the description that Nazis used to use to describe Jews, and it has become a dog whistle for neo-Nazis in this country and white nationalists or supremacists as a Jewish slur. And what I don't think everybody realizes is that Chuck Todd's Jewish. And so it's really, you know, it's once again the president using these coded words that not everybody understands to really, you know, make it clear where he stands on a lot of issues around race and religion and everything that could possibly unite us, but he's using it to divide us.
Alan has a couple of letters. We'll go there, and then we'll move on to other topics.
Okay, Joe. Mary says, authorization for the use of military force bill. Could the panel please discuss the pros and cons of the Corker-Kane authorization for the use of military force bill? People have been campaigning for Congress to limit Trump's power to wage war, but Credo.com and WinWithoutWar.com are campaigning against the Corker-Kane bill, saying it would give Trump a blank check for war. What is reality, at least in regard to the Corker-Kane bill? And that's thanks from Mary.
All right.
Well, you know, nobody else is. Are you ready for this one?
You go first.
Well, there's not much to say for me except that the Constitution is quite clear about this. There ought to be, the president ought to, when he wants to go to war, and dropping bombs and by the hundreds and thousands is going to war, and that includes Democrats as well as Republicans, ought to go and ask the Congress for permission. He would not have gotten it in this case.
Right, and I can talk more to the politics rather than the substance of it. I'd have to do a little more research on the nuances of what the groups are. That mm-hmm. I know I'm familiar with the groups that letter writer is talking about, but I'm not familiar with their positions. But one of the things that they said is McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, said that, you know, he wants to protect his members who are up for election, so he doesn't want to bring that to the floor for a vote, and that a lot of senators like to be able to say that, you know, this requires our vote, but they don't want to take the vote because some of their constituents are concerned about it. So but the committee, I think, is going to report it out, and if McConnell wants to bring it up or not, it's up to him, but I think they're going to move the bill. There was a good hearing. You can go to C-SPAN and look at the hearing. There was a good hearing on it last week.
The next letter comes from Mark, who says, good morning. Absolutely love you guys. Thanks for all you do. I haven't heard you address Trump's hiring of Giuliani to bring the Mueller investigation to a quick end. So curious as to your thoughts.
Well, we should talk about that. Giuliani is part of the team now, and apparently his job is that of a fixer, to sort of go in, find out what's going on, clear up any misunderstandings, and hopefully get the show on the road.
Yeah.
Says he knows Mueller. He knows Mueller, and he can deal with Mueller. I find him to be so reprehensible that I can't even look at his face in the you know, in the paper, to be honest with you. It's just awful.
Right, right before all those emails dropped, he was winking and nodding on Fox News saying something big is coming down the pike.
Yeah, they've got something on Mueller.
Right. So the thinking is that the FBI in New York were very close to Giuliani because he was, after all,
mayor
and also
U.S. attorney.
U.S. attorney, right. Yeah. So you have to wonder, you know, what was going on and if we'll ever find out about that.
You mean
I'm fascinated to find out.
I think that. Wasn't he referring to the fact that he was going to get hired?
Yeah. No.
Well,
this was
no. Oh. What you're saying is very important. Right. This is a thing I was railing on last year that former Mayor Giuliani and James Kallstrom, who had run the bureau, the FBI bureau, from check this 95 to 97. So Giuliani went on Fox, a couple of different programs. And talked about there's something big coming. There's something big coming. You just
this
wait.
This is in the 2016 election.
This is during the election.
In mid-October, right before the announcement by...
Just before Comey announced that they... Of the Huma Abedin computer emails. And so the weekend prior to that announcement, he was on two, maybe three different shows. And in fact, they've replayed them recently in this weirdly funny laugh. Just wait. We have one more thing coming. And at that time, James Kallstrom was talking about how the New York office was so upset because they weren't prosecuting Hillary Clinton. And so Comey has said that he referred that, you know, the question is, was there some meddling? Was there improper information shared that shouldn't have been shared? And this situation, Comey has now recently said he did refer this to be reviewed if there was any improper conduct, but we don't know what happened. But now, so Giuliani, who was involved in this issue around the emails and the FBI activities, is then going to be his lawyer. It seems pretty complicated.
All right. And there just one quick thing, but there was another attorney who left. One of the attorneys who left working for Trump also came in saying they had the experience of working with Mueller, which did not work out in any meaningful way, right?
Yeah, I don't think Mueller is going to be cowed by a Rudy Giuliani or anyone else.
And Rudy Giuliani said that he's going to come in and solve this in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah,
he's going to close this down in the next 2 weeks. So some people read that to mean that he's going to have him fire Mueller, but that's not going to happen. You can't. As Comey and others have said, you can't shut it down in 2 weeks. They're not going to resolve this in 2 weeks. And you have now the case in the Southern District.
So that, you know, I think lately Trump has been tweeting about the whole thing being illegitimate. So sure. You have to wonder, is Giuliani whispering in his ear and saying, you know, fruit of the poison tree, they can't do anything to you because this all stemmed from Comey and illegally leaked memos and all that sort of stuff. So it's getting very hairy, very... complex.
Let's not forget the Steele dossier. I read this incredibly long piece in the New Yorker that was from March, and all about the dossier and that how there were some items in there and some conversations that also could be, you could say, oh, it's the fruit of a rotten tree.
Right.
And so they'll use all of that to just undermine. But I don't think absolutely. Mueller will fall for it.
Well. Here's the deal. I've been saying all along, when Trump has absolutely nowhere else to go and doesn't have a choice, he will fire Mueller.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's clear to me. There are many people who say, no, he won't fire Mueller. I think that if he has no other choice, and if it means the end of his presidency and everything else, he will fire Mueller.
Mm-hmm. And Mike Pence will pardon him.
Maybe. Certainly there's precedent for that one.
Well, the thing is, I mean, this is such a major diplomatic week in the U.S. and around the world. I mean, you have two heads of state coming to the U.S. You have a major meeting between the North and the South Koreans that has global implications. You have, Paris Treaty. You have all sorts of issues. And what did we see this weekend from the President of the United States while you were burying, you know, in the midst of a funeral for the former First Lady Barbara Bush? He had a, you know, tirade or whatever you want to call it of tweets around these issues, not about global issues, not dignified tweets about the First Lady, but all about Cohen and how is this and Clinton and so on and so forth. It's just really sad for our country right now.
This man is a narcissist beyond all narcissists. So it's always going to be about him. It's always going to be about saving his hide.
And what's troubling is, again, it's just this undermining of everything that is important to democracy,
mm-hmm.
the institutions.
Right.
And it's just a constant like flow underneath the institutions and the bedrock of our democracy. And, you know, it's creeping up. I mean, those of us around the table may pay more attention, but when all is said and done, whatever happens 2 years from now, we're going to be looking at rubble.
Yes.
We're
going to
be looking at
yes.
real
and rebuilding
damage.
Those institutions of democracy won't happen overnight.
Well, it's I read some South Korean papers yesterday just to see because, you know, how do they view what's going on? And one of the fears that I saw in several of the stories is that Trump will cut a deal with North Korea just because he wants to be able to say that he's mm-hmm. the one who mm-hmm. ended the war between right. North and South Korea. And the fear is that if he can get an agreement on long-range ballistic missiles, that's all he cares about, and then that leaves them, you know,
what about Japan?
It leaves them more vulnerable.
Right. So,
and so they have a real fear that Trump is going to try to cut a deal that is not good for the region, but is good for him because he has so many political problems at home. That's untenable.
Nixon and China, Trump and Korea. I mean, he's a real Nixon fan. Mm-hmm. I'm not equating.
Yeah,
him.
I don't think
no,
that
no,
there's.
No, no.
Yeah, yeah.
But,
I mean,
but
I think
I mean, in his mind,
Nixon understood China.
Oh, of course.
He
That's
understood China.
Right?
Nixon understood. For whatever else you say about Nixon.
Oh yeah,
Nixon understood the world very well.
The title, but the title.
Yes.
No,
I see what you're saying.
The headline would be.
Right, that he'd have a place in history.
Looking increasingly better, Nixon.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just amazing.
John, who is a frequent critic, says, Iran deal. It has been stated by all critics, including our president, of the deal that falls short in two areas. One, Iran can continue to develop a delivery system, long-range ballistic missiles. And two, after 13 years, Iran is permitted to restart their enrichment program. So just kicking the can down the road, how is it that Teresa is not aware of these main objections and only states it's just a campaign promise?
Hmm? You're staring. You don't want to take the bait on that one?
No, no, no. I have to admit something.
Yeah, you weren't listening.
I was reading. He's tweeting about Mexico. And remember I said how the Mexican presidents and with the German chancellor today announcing a deal? And I was reading his recent tweet tirade in the last few minutes about Mexico. I'm so sorry.
No, not to worry. It happens to the best of us.
Yeah.
And to me more than others. Steven says,
let me read it.
You see that, you can respond. Okay, go ahead.
Sleepy-eyed. Esteem panels, calling someone sleepy-eyed is plain and simple, unnecessary name-calling. He's done this bullying with leaders of other countries, members of Congress and the Senate, et cetera, et cetera. It's a damn bullying tactic that, parenthesis, surprise, plays to the base and to his base. And there we are from Steve from wherever.
Okay, so on this, I just read it, but I said that they're claiming they don't like the ballistic missiles issue, which wasn't in the treaty, and that's what this talks about, the ballistic missiles. And then after 13 years, Iran is permitted to restart their enrichment program. Well, as I understand it, what this really means is after the deal there is a sunset in the deal.
Right.
But they were asked about that yesterday, and they always say that, you know, we have said that we're not going to restart our program. And, of course, treaties have timelines, and this treaty, like all treaties, has timelines. And this is the deal. The bottom line is this is a deal that was negotiated. All the parties agreed to it with the terms that were in it. And so if the president gets out of it, he's reneging on a deal. And how can he go to the table to make a deal with the North Koreans if in the same week that he reneges on this one?
Joel says, Chuck Todd is Jewish. Sleepy-eyed is a slur aimed at Jews. Look it up. Joel from Blooming Grove.
We did.
Check and check.
Right.
And Dan, go ahead.
The other thing I wanted to just mention, because I was reading some of the letters, is that everyone who was shot at the Waffle House was Black or Hispanic.
Yes.
And this guy who did the shooting considers himself a sovereign citizen, which the FBI considers a terrorist group. You know, sovereign citizens are the folks that don't think they have to play by the rules, pay taxes, be a part. They see themselves as patriots, but they're really terrorists.
Real quick, let's talk about Puerto Rico and what's going on there as far as the power being restored and also just some of the economic troubles that are plaguing the...
Well, I was shocked to hear. First of all, Puerto Rico is still trying desperately to come out of all of the horrific damage that has happened. And we know that FEMA's been slow, that they've been contracting with incompetent contractors to deliver services. You can go online and read all about it. What is really frightening to me was something I heard recently, that the governor of Puerto Rico, Governor Rosselló, is going to be closing about 280 schools throughout Puerto Rico. And part of this is the whole PROMESA plan, the bankruptcy plan. And again, it just points to the fact that Puerto Rico is being treated as second class, the people of Puerto Rico, mm-hmm. being treated as second class citizens. And if you go and you look at what happened in Houston versus what happened in Puerto Rico, and the fact that aid was so much faster going to Houston than it was to Puerto Rico, less helicopters in the same amount of time. And then I just can't wrap my head around the fact that they're just claiming the official count is still 64 people. And I've spoken to so many people.
Fatalities,
yes, I'm sorry. And it's more like 1,500 people, if not more, and we'll probably never know how many people perished. And a lot of that had to do with the slowness of the response of the federal government. Sure. And it's really something that people should be outraged at, not just Puerto Rican people.
Just think of all the people on dialysis, for example, mm-hmm. when you can't get electricity.
Absolutely. And the grid is still fragile, as we know. Just 2 days ago, 3 days ago, the whole island went black again.
Went black again.
Right. And we're approaching hurricane season again.
This is racism at its... at its best.
But why?
I mean, it really... Why?
It seems so stupid.
It is stupid. It's incredibly stupid. But, you know, these are people... I mean, I don't even know if Trump realizes they're American citizens. That's number one.
Right.
You know, I don't think he did. And, you know, they're not people with means, and they're just not important.
And mostly Democratic.
And they're people of color. And so they're not important to him and to this administration.
Can I give a shameless plug real
quick?
Yes,
absolutely.
On June 1st... at the former St. John's Church, Capital District Latinos will be hosting a troop from Puerto Rico that went throughout the island to the 78 municipalities in Puerto Rico and performed a guerrilla theater piece called Ay Maria, and we're bringing it to Albany, and it's going to be at 5:30 on June 1st, so save the date.
Right.
But the day will be a day of celebration and information about Puerto Rico, so we'll send more information as time goes on. But save the date. Please come and see Ay Maria and the rest of the festivities on that day.
St. Joseph's is?
It's St. John's Lutheran Church. It used to be. It's been out of commission. We purchased the church about six months ago.
And where is it?
On 160 Central Avenue.
We're out of time. Okay. Go on there.